Agony means, look at you, lad, riding around without a copper to your name. Ye gods, you should be getting yourself a place in a war band and working at rising to captain.
Now here, Perro, Gwerna broke in. You're welcome at our table any time you pass by.
Course he is, woman, Benwick snapped. That's not the point. He should be making summat of himself, that's all. I don't know what's wrong with you, lad. And your cursed cousin Neth is even worse. At least there's some excuse for you.
My thanks.
But Neth's got Dun and Domain both, and all he does is ride around hunting all day, by the Lord of Hell's balls.
Now, my love, Gwerna interceded again. He and Perrin are both young yet.
20, both of them, old enough to marry and settle down.
Well, here, Uncle, I can hardly take a wife when I don't even have a house to put her in.
That's what I mean. There's some excuse for you.
Perrin smiled feebly. Although he was a member of the northern branch of the ancient and conjoint wolf clan and was thus entitled to be called a lord, he was also the fifth son of a land-poor family, which meant that he owned naught but the title and a long string of relatives to play unwilling host when he turned up at their gates.
Are you riding Neth's way when you leave us?
Benwick asked.
I am. On the morrow, I was thinking.
Then tell him I want to hear of him marrying, and soon.
The next morning, Perrin rose at dawn and went to the stable long before the dun came awake. He brought out his dapple-grey gelding, a fine horse with some western hunter blood in him, and began saddling up. On his travels he packed an amazing amount of gear. 2 pairs of saddlebags, a bulging bedroll, a small iron kettle, and at his saddle-peak a woodcutter's axe, slung where most lords carried a shield. Just as he was finishing, Benwick came out to look the laden horse over.
By the asses of the gods, you look like a misbegotten peddler. Why don't you take a pack horse if you're going to live on the roads this way?
Good idea.
With a snort, Benwick ran his hand down the grey's neck.
Splendid creature. Where did a young cub like you scrape up the coin for him?
Well...
Perrin needed a lie fast.
Won him in a dice game.
Might have known. Ye gods, you and your blasted cousin are going to drive me to the other lands before my time.
When he left the dun, Perrin set off down the west running road in search of a pack horse. Around him stretched the fields of Benwick's domain, pale green with young barley. Here and there, farmers trotted through the crops to shoo away the crows, who rose with indignant caws and a clatter of wings. Soon, though, the fields gave way as the road rose into the rocky hills, dark with pines. Perrin turned off the muddy track that passed for a road and worked his way through the widely spaced, silent trees. Once he was in wild country, he had no need of roads to find his way. Early in the afternoon, he reached his goal, a mountain meadow in a long valley that belonged to a certain Lord Nurtin, one of his uncle's vassals, but a man Perrin particularly disliked. Out in the tall grass, 20 head of Nurtin's horses grazed peacefully, guarded by the stallion of the herd, a sturdy chestnut who stood a good 16 hands high. When Perrin walked toward the herd, the stallion swung his way with a vicious snort, and the others threw up their heads and watched, poised to run. Perrin began talking to the stallion, a soft clucking noise, a little murmur of meaningless sound, until the horse relaxed and allowed Perrin to stroke his neck. At that, the rest of the herd returned to their feed.
"I need to borrow one of your friends," Perrin said. "I hope you don't mind. I'll take splendid care of him."
As if he agreed, the stallion tossed his head, then ambled away. Perrin picked out a bay gelding and began patting its neck and combing its mane with his fingers.
"Aren't you sick of that fat lord who owns you? Come along and see summit of the road."
When the gelding turned its head, Perrin smiled at it in a particular way he had, a deep smile that made him feel slightly cool, as if some of his warmth was flowing out to the recipient of the smile. With a soft snort, the bay leaned its head against his chest. He patted it for a few more minutes, then walked away, the bay following close behind. Although Perrin honestly didn't understand why, once he got a few minutes alone with a horse, the animal would follow him anywhere without halter or rope. It was a useful trick. Whenever his coin ran low, he would simply take a horse from someone he disliked and sell it to one of the dishonest traders he knew. Because of his noble blood, no one ever suspected him of being the worst horse thief in the northern provinces. He'd often stolen a horse from a cousin one week, then ridden back the next to express surprise and sympathy at the loss. Only Benwick and Nedd were safe from his raiding. That night, Perrin and the two horses made a comfortable camp in a forest clearing, but the next day they had to return to the road or go miles out of their way around a steep hill. They had barely reached the track when it began to rain. Perrin kept riding until the mud made travelling difficult for the horses, then turned a little way into the forest and dismounted. In the imperfect shelter of the pines, he crouched down between the horses and waited for the storm to slack. It was uncomfortable, of course, with his clothes stuck to him and water running into his boots, but he ignored the discomfort, the way forest deer ignored the rain, browsing in the wet when they were hungry. If someone had asked him what he thought about during those two cold hours, he wouldn't have been able to say. He was merely aware of things. The rain, the smell of pine, the slick wet trunks and pale green ferns. Every sound brought a message. A squirrel scuttling into its hole, a deer moving cautiously far away, a stream running close by. Eventually the rain stopped. By the time he reached Nedd's Dun, he was dry again. Indeed, he'd quite forgotten that he'd been caught by the storm. The dun stood on a muddy hillock behind a crumbling stone wall and a pair of rusty iron-bound gates that squeaked like a demon when Perrin shoved them open. Instead of a broch, Nedd had a stone roundhouse with a roof that leaked all around the edge and two hearths that smoked badly. Although there were the usual barracks over the stables for a warband, the roof there was so bad that Nedd had simply moved his 10 men into the half-round of a room that passed for his great hall. They slept on straw mattresses, laid in any which way, in the dry spots out in the middle of the room. Nedd, as befitted his rank, had an actual bed by one hearth. Scattered through this disorder of mouldy straw were also 2 tables, benches, a collection of leather buckets for drips, and 1 elegant chair, carved with the wolf blazon. When Perrin came in after stabling his horses, he found his cousin sitting in the chair with his feet on one of the tables.
"By the gods," Nedd said with a grin, "you've come like an omen, cousin. Here, fetch yourself some ale. There's an open barrel by the other hearth."
Since their mothers were sisters, the cousins looked much alike. They both had flaming red hair, freckles and bright blue eyes. But while Nedd was a good-looking man, the most charitable description of Perrin would have been nondescript. Tankard in hand, he joined Nedd at his table. At the other, the warband were drinking and dicing.
"Why have I come like an omen?"
"You're just in time to ride to war with me."
Nedd smiled as if he were offering a splendid gift.
"I've got this ally to the west, Tyrin Greymin. You've met him, haven't you? And he sent out a call for aid. I'm supposed to bring him 12 men, but I've only got 10, so I've got to scrape up the other 2 somewhere. Come along, cousin. It'll be good sport, and you can spare me the cost of a silver dagger."
Seeing no way out, Perrin sighed. Nedd had fed him for many a winter, and besides, a noble lord was supposed to respond joyously to the call for war. He forced out a smile.
"Oh, gladly," he said. "And what's the war about?"
"Cursed if I know. I just got the message today."
"Can you spare me a shield?"
"Of course. Ye gods, Perro, don't tell me you ride without one."
Well, I do at that. They take up too much space on your saddle."
"You should have been born a woodcutter, I swear it."
Perrin rubbed his chin and considered the suggestion.
"Just jesting," Nedd said hurriedly. "Well, I hope a silver dagger turns up soon. There's always a lot of them in Caer Gonny. We'll wait a couple of days, then ride, even if we're 1 short. Better that than riding in after the fighting's over."
The gods, however, apparently decided that if Lord Nedd was going to march to war, it might as well be straight away. On the morrow, not long after breakfast, the kitchen gardener ambled in to announce that there was a silver dagger at the gates.
"And he's got a woman with him too," the old man said. "I feel cursed sorry for her kin."
"Is she pretty?" Nedd said.
"She is."
Nedd and Perrin shared a small smile.
"Splendid," Nedd said. "Send them in, will you?"
In a few minutes, the silver dagger and his woman came in, both of them travel-stained and roughly dressed, the lass in men's clothing, with a sword and silver dagger of her own. Although her blonde hair was cropped short like a lad's, she was not merely pretty, but beautiful, with wide blue eyes and a delicate mouth.
"Good morrow, my lords."
The silver dagger made them a courtly bow.
"My name's Rodri of Aberwyn, and I heard in your village that you've got a hire for the likes of me."
"I do," Nev said. "I can't offer you more than a silver piece a week, but if you serve me well in the war, I'll shelter you and your lass all winter."
Rodri glanced up at the roof, where sunlight broke through in long shafts, then down at the floor, where Nev's dog snored in mildewed straw.
"Winter's a long way away, my lord. We'll be riding on."
"Oh, well," Nev said hastily, "I can squeeze out 2 silver pieces a week, and there'll be battle loot too."
"Done then. His lordship is to be praised for his generosity."
For Jill's sake, Lord Nerth gave his silver dagger an actual chamber to sleep in instead of a mattress out in the great hall. Although the wickerwork walls were filthy, it did have a door. Rather than sit on the straw of the floor, which seemed to be inhabited, Jill perched on top of an unsteady wooden chest and watched as Rodri cleaned his chainmail. As he ran an old rag through the rings to wipe away the rust, he was frowning in the candlelight.
"What are you thinking about?" she said.
"That old saying, as poor as a caregonny lord."
"Lord Ned's a marvel and a half, isn't he? Are we actually going to stay here all summer and the winter too?"
"Of course not. I'd rather sleep beside the roads. Are you sure you'll fare well enough when I leave you behind?"
"Oh, no doubt the kennel will be comfortable enough when the dogs are all out of it. How long do you think the war will last?"
"War?"
He looked up with a grin.
"I wouldn't dignify it with a word, my love. If Ned's allies are anything like him, no doubt there'll be a lot of shouting and skirmishing, and then an end to it."
"I hope you're right. I feel danger coming in this."
His smile gone, he laid the mail aside.
"More of your wretched Dwayoma."
"Just that. But it's not battle danger, exactly. I'm not even sure what I do mean. Forgive me. I shouldn't have said anything at all."
"I wish you hadn't, truly."
He hesitated for a long moment, staring down at the straw.
Oh, by the black ass of the Lord of Hell, let's just forget it."
"I know what you want to know. I don't see your death coming. Ah, ye gods, if ever I did, don't you think I'd beg you not to ride to war?"
"And what good would that do? When my weird comes upon me, I'll die as easily from a fever or a fall from a horse as from a sword cut." "Let me beg a boon from you, my love. If ever you see my death, say not a word about it."
"I won't, then. I promise."
With a nod of thanks, he got up, stretching, and looked down at the mail glittering in the candlelight. He was so beautiful that she felt like weeping, that he would have to risk his life in the petty feuds of men like Lord Neth. As she always did on the nights before he was about to ride to war, she wondered if he would live to ride back to her.
"Let's lie down together, my love," he said. "It's going to be a long while before I sleep in your bed again."
Once she was lying in his arms, Jill felt the wondering grow to a cold stab, closer and closer to fear. She held him tight and let his kisses drown it away. Early on the morrow, the warband made a sloppy muster out in the ward. Jill stood in the doorway and watched as the men drew their horses up in a straggling line behind the two lords. The 4 men at the rear, including Rodri, led pack horses laden with provisions because Nerth didn't own an ox cart and couldn't have spared the farmers to drive it if he had. Just as it seemed the line was finally formed, someone would yell that he'd forgotten something and dash back to the house or the stables. At the very last moment, Nerth discovered that Perrin didn't own a pot helm. A servant was dispatched to the stables, which apparently did double duty as an armory, to look for one. Perrin stood rubbing the back of his neck with one hand, while Nerth berated him for a woodcutter and worse. When Jill caught Rodri's eye, he sighed and glanced heavenward to call the gods to witness Perrin's eccentricity. She had never seen a noble lord like Perrin, and she didn't know whether to laugh or cry over him. He was tall, but slender and ill-proportioned, with narrow shoulders, long arms, and big, heavy hands, out of scale to the rest of him. Although his face wasn't truly ugly, his eyes were enormous, his mouth thin, and his nose on the flat side. When he walked, he had all the grace of a stork strutting. When the servant came back with a rusty helm, Neth announced that if anyone had forgotten anything else, he'd cursed will have to do without it. Jill gave Rodri one last kiss, then ran to the gates to wave the warband out. In a disorderly line, they trotted down the hill, then into the road, disappearing to the west in a spatter of mud. With a prayer to the goddess to keep her man safe, Jill turned back to the dun and the long tedium of waiting for news. The small domain of Tyrin Greymin lay 3 days' ride to the west of Neth's dun. The road ran narrow through sharp hills and scrubby pine, mostly uninhabited, until some 10 miles from the Tyrin's dun, the warband came to a small village, Speybrin, one of three that paid Greymin allegiance. As the warband watered their horses at the village well, Perrin noticed the townsfolk watching with frightened eyes. A Caergonny war was like a Caergonny storm, blowing the thatch from cottage and lord's manor alike. Late in the afternoon they reached Greymin's dun, set up on a low hill out in the middle of a stretch of fairly flat pasture land, bordered by trees. The big gate swung open to admit them into a ward crowded with men and horses. As Ned's warband dismounted, stable boys ran to take their horses and lead them away into the general confusion. The Tyrin himself strolled out to greet these reinforcements. A grizzled, dark-haired man, he bulged with muscles under his linen shirt.
"I'm truly glad to see you, Neth," he remarked. "Your 12 brings us up to what strength we're going to have."
Under the Tyrin's firm voice there was an anxious edge that made Perrin apprehensive, and for good reason, as it turned out, at the Council of War in the Great Hall. Even with Neth and 3 other allies, Greymin had only some 200 men. Ranged against them were Tyrin Nathric and his allies with close to 300. The dispute concerned 2 square miles of borderland between their domains, but it had grown far beyond the land at stake. Although Greymin was willing to submit the matter to the arbitration of the High King, Nathric had refused the offer some weeks past. In a subsequent skirmish between mounted patrols, Nathric's only son had been killed.
"So, he wants my blood," Greymin finished up. "I've stripped the countryside to provision the dun. You never know what's going to happen when a man gets it into his head to start a blood feud."
The other lords all nodded sagely, while Perrin devoutly wished that he had been born a woodcutter. A feud could rage for years, and here he was, honour-bound to ride in it for Neth's sake. After the meal, the lords gathered round the honour table and studied a rough map of eastern Caergonny. They drank over it, argued over it, and yelled at each other, while Perrin merely listened. He was part of the council only by courtesy to his birth. Since he had no warband, he had no right of decision. He stayed until the lords adopted Ned's plan of making a surprise attack on the enemy's line of march, then slipped away, getting a candle lantern from a page and taking it out to the stables. When he found his dapple grey, he hung the lantern on a nail in the wall of the stall and sat up on the manger. The grey leaned his face into Perrin's chest with a small snort. He gently scratched its ears.
"Well, my friend, I wonder if I'll live to see the winter. I truly do."
Blissfully unaware that there was such a thing as a future to consider, the grey nibbled on his shirt.
"At least you'll be safe and out of it. That's something to be glad about."
If Caergonny men had fought on horseback, as warriors did in most of Deverry, no amount of honour or obligation would have induced Perrin to ride to war. But since up in that grain-poor province horses were too valuable to slaughter, Caergonny men rode to battle but dismounted to fight. Yet even though he knew his friend would be safe, Perrin's heart ached at the thought of battle. As he did every time he was forced to ride to war, he wondered if he was simply a coward. Doubtless every lord in the province would have considered him one if they discovered his true feelings about honour and battle glory, which seemed far less important to him than fishing in a mountain stream or sitting in a meadow and watching the deer graze. At times like these, the old proverb haunted him, "What does a man have worth having but his honour?" A good bit more to Perrin's way of thinking. But he could never voice that thought to anyone, not even Neth, no matter how much he simply wanted to ride away from killing men he didn't know in a war that never should have happened in the first place.
"Ah, well, my friend, my weird will come when it comes, I suppose. I wonder if horses have weirds. It's a pity you can't talk. We could have a splendid chat about that, couldn't we?"
Suddenly he fell silent, hearing someone open the stable door. His silver dagger gleaming in the lantern light, Rodri strode briskly down the line of stalls.
"Oh, it's you, my lord. The tyrant's captain detailed me to keep an eye on the stables, you see, and I heard someone talking."
Rodri glanced around, puzzled.
"Isn't someone else here?"
Well, I was just talking to my horse."
Rodri's eyes glazed with a suppressed mockery that Perrin was used to seeing on men's faces.
"I see. My lord, can I ask you if we're riding out tomorrow?"
"We are. Going to make a flank attack, give them a bit of a surprise."
Rodri smiled in honest pleasure at the news. He was handsome, strong and eager for battle, just the sort of man that Perrin was supposed to be, and the type who always despised him. Perrin wasn't sure if he envied or hated the silver dagger. Both, he decided later. On the morrow, the army mustered before dawn in a ward bright with flaring torchlight. The men were silent, the lords grim, the horses restless, stamping, tossing their heads at every wink of light on helm and sword. As usual, Nedd's warband was the last to take their place in line, shouting at each other and squabbling over who would ride with whom. As he took his place beside his cousin, Perrin noticed Rodri, smiling to himself as if he were gloating over a beautiful woman.
"We're going to cut straight across country," Nedd said. "We'll need you to scout, Perro."
"No doubt. None of you could find your way through a copse to a mountain, I swear it."
"Even woodcutters have their uses."
Perrin merely shrugged. The restlessness of the horses was making him wonder if disaster lay ahead of them. Sometimes animals could tell such things, in his experience. At last, Greymon blew his silver horn. As the first dawn silvered the sky, the gate swung open. With his sword raised high, the tyrant rode out, his personal warband clattering behind him, four abreast, the line snaking out and down the hill. Suddenly, Perrin heard distant war cries, as if someone were racing to meet Greymon beyond the walls. The men nearest the gates screamed in rage. The horns rang out to arm and charge. Natherick had prepared a surprise of his own. The war turned into a shoving, shouting chaos as men dismounted, grabbing shields and helms, and rushed out the gates. Perrin swung down, then gave the grey one last pat.
"Farewell, and pray to Epona that we meet again."
Then he ran after Nedd and out the gates. The battle was sweeping halfway up the hill, a raging, ragged swirl of men and riderless horses, as Natherick's men struggled up while Greymon's tried to shove them back. In the dust pluming upward, Perrin lost sight of Nedd almost at once. A burly fellow with an enemy blazon of blue and yellow on his shield charged him and swung in hard from the right. Perrin flung up his shield, caught the blow and thrust it away, then swung back, slapping his opponent hard on the thigh. Cursing, the man stumbled. Perrin got a hard cut on his sword arm. Bleeding, the man withdrew, fainting, parrying more than he swung. As he followed, Perrin realized that the enemy tide was ebbing back down the hill. Screaming war cries, Greymon's men swept after.
"We should hold this higher ground," Perrin thought.
But it was too late, and no one would have taken orders from him, even if he tried to give them. Down on the flat, the battle reformed itself into random knots and mobs of fighting. As Perrin ran toward the closest one, he suddenly heard laughter off to one side, a bubbling sort of chuckle that rose now and then to a howl over the smack and clang of swords striking shield and mail. It was such an eerie sound that for a moment he paused, looking this way and that to try to find the source. That brief curiosity cost him dear. At a shout behind him, he turned to see three men running straight for him, and they all carried the blue and yellow shield. With a yelp of terror, Perrin flung up his shield and sword barely in time to parry the two hard blows that swung in on him. Although the third man dodged past and ran on, the other two enemies closed in for a quick, if dishonorable, kill. As he desperately dodged and parried, Perrin heard the laughter again, shrieking, sobbing, ever louder, until all at once Rodri lunged at the man attacking from the right and killed him with two quick slashes, back and forth, with a gesture like waving away a fly. Gasping for breath, Perrin took a wild swing at the other blue and yellow, missed, nearly tripped, and regained his balance, just in time to see the man fall, spitted in the back through the joining of his mail. Rodri jerked his sword free with a shake to scatter the drops of blood.
"My thanks, Silver Dagger,"
Perrin gasped.
For an answer, Rodri merely laughed, and his eyes were so glittering wild that for a moment Perrin was afraid he'd turn on him. Yelling at the top of their lungs, five men from Ned's warband ran up and swept Rodri and Perrin along toward a hard knot of fighting around Greymin himself. Although Perrin tried to keep up, the entire line was swirling and breaking, falling back around him as Natheric's superior numbers began to tell. He got cut off as two of his allies shoved past him, running for their lives. When he ran for a man he thought was one of Ned's, the fellow swung his way and raised a shield marked with the red acorns of another enemy warband. Swearing, Perrin charged, but something struck him from behind. Fire stabbed, then spread down his shoulder. All at once, his fingers were loosening on the sword's hilt of their own will. He swirled around and caught a strike on his shield, but when he tried to raise his right arm, his fingers dropped the sword. Then he felt the blood, sheeting down his arm and pouring into his gauntlet. As the enemy pressed in, Perrin brought up the shield like a weapon and swung hard as he dodged back, stumbling over uncertain ground, yet there were enemies behind him. With a shout of desperation, Perrin charged and rammed the shield full strength into the enemy in front of him. Taken utterly off guard by this suicidal maneuver, the man slipped and fell backward. A startled Perrin fell on top of him, with his shield caught between them and his whole weight slamming it down. The enemy's head jerked back and he lay still, whether dead or merely stunned, Perrin neither knew nor cared. He scrambled up, shamelessly threw his shield and ran for the dun, but only for a few yards. Suddenly he realized that the battle was lost, that the field belonged to the enemy, that the last of his comrades were fleeing through the gates, just ahead of a line of blue and yellow shields. He fell to his knees and watched as the gates swung shut. Enemies ran past, shouting to one another.
"They're going to stand a siege, horse-run bastards! Get to the postern!"
No one even looked at the half-dead warrior slumped on the ground. It occurred to Perrin that without his shield, no one would even recognize him as an enemy in this confusion. His head spinning, he staggered to his feet and grabbed a sword with his left hand from a nearby corpse, then took off, trotting after the others and yelling, "To the postern!" While he didn't give a pig's fart about Greymin, Nedd was trapped in the dun in a half-provisioned siege, with no one to lift it. Greymin had called in every ally he had for this battle. In the dust-smeared milling mob, the ruse worked well. He kept up with them for about 20 yards, then fell back and ran for the trees edging the battlefield. If anyone even saw him go, they had no time to chase after. Among the pines, neatly tethered, were Natheric's horses, with only a couple of servants to guard them. Perrin charged the nearest horse handler, who promptly broke and ran. In one smooth slash, Perrin cut a tether rope, threw the sword away, and grabbed the reins of a solid chestnut gelding.
"Good horse! Please help me!"
The chestnut stood patiently as Perrin hauled himself into the saddle. Keeping to the trees, he rode away from the battle. Although every step the horse took made the world swim in front of him and his dangling right arm throb, he bit his lower lip until it bled and kept riding. He had to get news to Benwick. That was the only thought he allowed himself to have. When he reached the road, he kicked the horse to a gallop and stayed on by sheer force of will. Gallop, trot, walk. On and on he went, reminding himself that he could get help in Spaebryn. Although he wondered at times if he'd live to reach the village, the blood was drying on his arm, not welling up fresh. Just before noon, he crested the last hill above Spaebryn and pulled the horse to a halt. For a long time he stared down at the glowing spread of ashes and charred timbers, half hidden under a drift of smoke. The breeze brought with it a sickening smell, too much like roasted pork. Some of the villagers had waited too long to flee.
"Ah, ye gods! Our Natheric takes his revenge a bit too seriously, if you ask me."
The gelding snorted and tossed its head, spooked by the smell of burning. Perrin urged him on, skirted the ruins, and turned back into the pine forest.
Even though he could neither raise his arm nor move his fingers, he was going to have to try to ride back to Neth's Dun on his own. By taking side trails through wild country, he could shorten the distance to some 40 miles. Once they were well among the trees, he paused the horse again and thought of the Dun, pictured it clearly in his mind, and remembered all the warm, safe times he'd enjoyed Neth's company there. Then he went on, heading straight for it. Every time he started drifting from the most direct path, he felt a deep discomfort, something like a fear or anxiety, pricking at him. As soon as he turned the right way, the discomfort vanished. Although he didn't understand it in the least, this trick had led him back to places he thought of as home many a time in the past. Perrin picked his way through the forest until sundown, then dismounted and led his horse through the dark for a few miles more, stumbling only to force himself up again until they reached a small stream. Slacking the horse's bit with his left hand seemed to take an eternity. Finally he got it free and let the gelding drink.
"My apologies, but there's no oats."
In a golden mist, the forest was spinning slowly around him. He sat down just before he fainted. Like sheep in a snowstorm, the remains of the army huddled in Graham's great hall that night, 80-odd men in decent shape, 20-some badly wounded. Rodri sat on the floor with the last 6 men of Neth's warband. No one spoke as they watched the table of honour across the hall, where Graymin and his allies talked, heads together, faces drawn and tight-lipped in the torchlight. Frightened serving lasses crept through the warband and doled out scant rations of watered ale. By the servant's hearth, a young page sat weeping, wondering most like if he'd ever see his mother again. Finally Neth left the honour table and limped back to his own men. He slid down the wall rather than sat until he could slump half upright in the straw.
"You should be lying down, my lord," Rodri said.
"The blasted cut's not that bad."
Neth laid his hand on his thigh as if trying to hide the bloody bandage.
"My apologies, my lord."
"Oh, and you have mine. We're all going to have to watch our cursed tempers."
Everyone nodded, looking at the floor, out into space, anywhere rather than at each other.
"We've got provisions for a good 6 weeks," the lord went on. "Longer if we start eating horses."
"Is there any chance for a parley?" Rodri asked.
"There's always a chance. Graymin's sending a herald out on the morrow."
Rodri watched the parley from a distance, because at dawn he drew a turn on guard up on the ramparts. Outside, Natheric's men had cleared the battlefield of corpses, leaving a torn, blood-stained stretch of bare ground for about 300 yards. Beyond that were the tents and horses of the besiegers. Around the Dun, well beyond javelin range, trotted a mounted patrol. In a rough count, Rodri estimated that Natheric had at least 130 men left. When the sun was about an hour's worth up in the sky, the gates opened, and Greymin's chamberlain, carrying a long staff wound with red ribbons, slipped out. The patrol trotted over to him, made honourable half-bows from their saddles, then escorted him over to the camp. Rodri leaned onto the ramparts and waited. When a flutter of crows flew past, cawing and dodging, he envied them their wings. Although the herald returned in about half an hour, Rodri had to wait to hear the news until he was relieved from watch. He scrambled down the ladder and hurried into the great hall, where the warbands were eating in an ominous silence. Although the other lords were gone, Neth was eating with his men. Rodri sat down and helped himself to a chunk of bread from a basket, but he looked expectantly at the lord.
"Natheric won't parley," Neth said quietly. "He's made Graymin one offer. If we surrender without a fight, he'll spare the women and children. Otherwise he'll raise the Dun and kill every living thing in it."
When Rodri swore under his breath, the other men nodded in stunned agreement.
"He's a hard man, Natheric," Ned went on, "and he's sworn a vow of blood feud." "And if we surrender, what then?" Rodri said. "Will he hang every man in the Dun?"
"Just that, Silver Dagger."
Rodri laid the chunk of bread back down. For a moment he wished that they'd sally, die fighting, die clean, instead of swinging like a horse thief. But there was the Tyrann's lady, her serving women, his daughters and little son.
"Ah well,"
Rodri said. Her hope's a better death than a fever. They say you jerk once and there's an end to it. For all your silver dagger, you're a decent man, Rodri of Aberwyn. I only hope that my noble allies are as honourable as you. Oh, here, my lord. You don't mean they're arguing about it? They are. Well, by the hells, we'll hold out for a while before we do anything at all. The bastard can wait for a few days while he savours his piss-poor victory. Why not wait until he starves us out? What if he changes his terms? I wouldn't put it past the horse son to demand prompt surrender if we were going to save one woman's life.
Perrin woke to sunlight streaming down between the trees, like golden spears of light to his dazed sight. When he sat up, he shrieked at the pulse of pain in his arm. On his knees, he crawled to the stream and drank, cupping the water in his left hand. Then he realized that his horse was gone. He staggered up, took a few steps, and knew that he would never be able to walk the remaining 20 miles to the dun. Fortunately, there was no reason that he'd have to. He walked another couple of yards, then went very still, waiting, barely thinking, until he felt the odd sensation, a quivering alertness, a certain knowledge that somewhere close was, if not that horse, then another. Following its lead, he angled away, ignoring the discomfort that told him he was no longer heading straight for the dun, and worked his slow way through the trees until at last he saw the brightening light ahead that meant a mountain meadow. The pull of a horse was so strong that he forgot himself, hurried, and banged his injured arm against a tree. When he yelped aloud, he heard an answering whicker just ahead. More cautiously this time, he went on, and broke free of the forest into a little grassy valley, where the chestnut was grazing, the reins tangling in the grass. When Perrin staggered over, the horse raised its head and nuzzled his good arm.
"Let's get that bridle off, my friend. If I die along the way, you'll starve if you get those reins wrapped around a bush or such like."
Taking the bridle off with only one hand was a long agony of effort, but at last he got it done. Leaning against the gelding for support, he went through the saddlebags and found the horse's previous owner's spare shirt and a chunk of venison jerky. He managed to tear the shirt into strips by using his teeth and made himself a rough sling, then ate the jerky while he rode on, guiding the horse with his knees. All afternoon they rode slowly, dodging through the widely spaced trees, climbing up and down the hills, until by sunset they'd made another 10 miles. When they found another meadow, he let the horse graze and envied him the grass with his stomach clenching in hunger. Although he was only intending to rest for a few moments, as soon as he sat down, sleep took him. When he woke, moonlight flooded the meadow. Nearby, the chestnut stood, head down and asleep. The night was unnaturally silent, not the cry of an owl, not the song of a cricket, nothing. As he sat up, wondering at the silence, he saw something, someone, standing at the edge of the meadow. With a whispered oath, he rose, wishing for the sword he'd left behind on the battlefield. The figure took one step forward, tall, towering in the moonlight. Or was it moonlight? He seemed to drip pale light as palpable as water, running down the strong, naked arms, glittering on the gold torque around his neck, shimmering on the massive antlers that sprang from a head, mostly cervine, though human eyes looked out of it. Perrin began to weep in a fierce, aching joy.
"Ceiron," he whispered, "my most holy lord."
The great head swung his way. The liquid dark eyes considered him not unkindly, but merely distantly. The god raised his hands in blessing to the man who was perhaps his last true worshipper in all of Deveri. Then he vanished, leaving Perrin wrapped in a shuddering awe that wiped all his pain and exhaustion away. With tears running down his face, he went to the place where the god had appeared and knelt on the grass, now god-touched and holy. Eventually, the chestnut raised its head with a drowsy nicker and broke the spell. Perrin mounted and rode on, guiding the horse instinctively through the dark forest. Although he rode for the rest of the night and on into the morning, he felt no hunger, no pain, his wound only a distant ache like a bee sting. About an hour after dawn, they came out of the trees just a mile from Nedd's dun. He trotted up to the hill, then dismounted and led the tired horse up to the gates. he heard shouts and people running, but all at once it was very hard to see. He concentrated on keeping his feet as Jill raced toward him.
"Lord Perrin, are they all lost then? Cursed Nia, besieged."
Then he fainted into a merciful darkness where it seemed a great stag came to meet him. Between them, Jill and a servant named Sabin got Perrin up onto a table in the great hall. As she soaked the blood-crusted shirt away from his wound, Jill found herself trying to remember every small thing Nevin had ever told her about herbcraft, but the memories did her little good, because she had no proper tools and precious few herbs. The only thing Sabin could turn up for a vulnerary was rosemary from the kitchen garden. At least Nevin had always said that any green herb was better than none. When she finally loosened the shirt from the wound, she sent Sabin off for more hot water and some mead, then carefully peeled the crusted linen away. Her grey gnome popped into reality and hunkered down on the table for a look.
"It's not as bad as I feared," Jill said to him. "See? It just sliced the muscle and missed those big blood vessels in the armpit."
With a solemn nod, the gnome tilted his head to one side and considered the unconscious man. All at once it leapt up and hissed like a cat, its skinny mouth gaping to show every fang, its arms extended and its hands curled like claws. Jill was so surprised at hearing it make a sound that she caught it barely in time when it launched itself at Perrin and tried to bite him.
"Stop that!"
She gave the gnome a little shake.
"What's so wrong?"
Its face screwed up in hatred, the gnome went limp in her hands.
"You can't bite Lord Perrin. He's ill already, and he's never done anything to you either."
The gnome shook its head yes, as if to say he had.
"What? Here, little brother, why don't you come back later and try to explain?"
It vanished just as Sabin returned with the stable boy behind him. Jill washed the wound with water, then had Sabin hold Perrin's arms down and the stable boy his feet. Gritting her teeth, she poured the mead directly into the open wound. With a howl of pain, Perrin roused from his faint and twisted round. It was all the two men could do to keep him lying there.
"My apologies, my lord," Jill said firmly, "but we've got to disperse the foul humours in this wound."
For a moment he merely gasped for breath, then he turned his head to look at her.
"Forgot where I was," he mumbled. "Go ahead."
Jill wadded up a bit of rag and made him bite on it, then washed the wound again. He trembled once, then lay so still that she thought he'd fainted again, but his eyes were open in a stubborn resistance to pain that she had to admire. Mercifully, the worst was over. She made a poultice of the rosemary leaves, laid it in the wound, then bound it up with clean linen.
"Benwick," he said at last, "I've got to ride to Benwick."
"You can't. You could bleed to death if you try. Tell me the message and I'll take it on."
"Ride to my uncle. Tell him Neth's trapped in Greymin's Dun."
His voice fell into a whisper.
"Your Rodri was still alive, last I saw of him."
"My thanks."
Although she nearly broke, she forced her voice steady.
"I'll pray that he still is."
While Sabin told her who Benwick was and what road to take to Prencluden, Jill cut one of the embroidered wolves from Perrin's bloody shirt to take as a token. When she rode out, she took two horses. By switching her weight back and forth, she would be able to ride it close to a courier's speed. As soon as she was well away from the dun, she called to her gnome, which promptly appeared on the saddle peak.
"Can you find Rodri? Can you tell me if he's still alive?"
It nodded yes, patted her hand, then disappeared.
Out on the road, where no one could see her, Jill allowed herself to cry. A little after dawn on the next day, Rodri climbed the ramparts and looked out over the dun wall. In the misty morning, the enemy camp was coming awake. Cooking fires blossomed among the dirty canvas tents, and men strolled around, yawning as they tended their horses. Just beyond the camp was the beginning of a circle of earthworks, about 20 feet so far, of packed mound edged with a ditch that would soon close them round and block any attempts at escape. It was also an unnecessary effort on Nathric's part. The decision had been made. Soon the lords would surrender and hang to spare the women and children. All that Rodri wanted was for it to be very soon to end the waiting. When he was 14 years old, he'd begun learning how to live prepared to die.
At 23 he was a master at that part of the warrior's craft. Now the day was upon him, but his weird would come at the end of a rope. To die by hanging, to be thrown into a ditch with 100 men who'd met the same priest-cursed end, to lie far from Eldith, unmarked, unmourned, nothing but a silver dagger who'd had the ill luck to take the wrong hire. That was his weird, was it? Rodri shook his head in sheer disbelief that all his berserk battle glory, that strange dwayum of prophecies and magical battles had led him to this, a thing so numbing that he felt no fear and very little grief. Only a dark hiraeth that he'd never see Jill again. What if he'd only ridden east instead of west, and been hired by Nathric instead of Neth? That would have been worse, he decided, to be party to this dishonourable scheme. He would die, and Nathric live, but at least he would have his honour, while the Lord had thrown his away for hatred's sake. Rodri was so wrapped in his brooding that when something tweaked his sleeve, he spun around, his sword out of its scabbard before he was aware of drawing. Jill's grey gnome stood on the rampart, grinning at him while it jigged up and down in excitement. Rodri felt a flare of hope. If only he could make the little creature understand, if only it could tell Jill. But what was she supposed to do then? Run to some great lord and say that the wild folk had told her the tale? The hope died again. "It's cursed good to see you, little brother. But do you realise what kind of evil has befallen me?" Much to his surprise, it nodded, yes, then held up one long finger as a sign to pay attention. Suddenly there were wild folk all around it, little blue sprites, fat yellow gnomes, strange grey fellows, and party-coloured ugly little lasses. Never had Rodri seen so many, a vast crowd along the rampart. "What is all this?" When the grey gnome snapped his fingers, the wild folk lined up in pairs, then began to bob up and down with a rhythmic motion, each with one hand held out before it. The grey gnome stood at the head of the line, with one hand out like the others, but the left raised as if holding a sword. Rodri finally understood.
"An army? Oh, by great Bel himself, do you mean that someone's riding to relieve this siege?"
The gnome leapt up and danced while it nodded yes. With a rushy sound, the rest of the pack disappeared. When Rodri's eyes filled with tears, he wiped them away, swallowing hard before he could speak.
"Did you tell Jill I was trapped here?"
This time the answer was no. The gnome sucked one finger for a moment, then began to walk back and forth while it imitated a stiff, clumsy, bow-legged gait.
"Lord Perrin, he escaped the battle."
Although the gnome nodded yes, its expression was peculiarly sour. It shrugged as if dismissing something, then leapt to Rodri's shoulder and kissed him on the cheek before it vanished. Rodri tossed his head back and laughed, until it occurred to him that now he had to convince the noble lords that rescue was on the way, that there was no need to surrender, without, of course, mentioning the wild folk.
"Oh, horse dung and a pile of it!"
All morning while he watched the mounted patrols ride round and round the dun, he went over and over the problem, trying out phrases, rejecting them, trying some more. Eventually, Lord Neth climbed awkwardly up the ladder onto the catwalk and limped over.
"Just thought I'd have a look at the bastards."
Neth leaned onto the wall and stared down, his red hair oddly dull in the sunlight as if he were ill.
"Oh well, at least we'll hang soon and get it over with." "Well, my lord, I was just thinking about that, and at least I don't have a widow to mourn me."
The lord went on as if he hadn't heard Rodri's tentative words.
"By the Lord of Hell's Balls, I'd always wanted my land to revert to Perrin if I died, and now he's died before me."
Neth was close to tears over his cousin's death, a surprising thing to Rodri, who considered him no great loss, or had considered him lost until just a few hours ago.
"Here, my lord. What if he escaped from the field?" "Oh, indeed. What if a crow sang like a little finch, too? Perrin wasn't much of a swordsman, Silver Dagger, and Nathric's bastards were slaughtering the wounded after the battle." "True spoken, but..." "I know what you're thinking," Neth snarled. "Why mourn poor Perrin? He's better off dead." "I wasn't, my lord. Naught of the sort." "My apologies. I forget you didn't know him well. By the asses of the gods, I got so blasted sick of all the chatter. What's wrong with your wretched cousin? How can you stand him in your dun? He's daft, he's a half-wit, he's this or he's that.
He wasn't daft at all, by the hells. A little, well, eccentric maybe, but not daft.
He sighed heavily.
Well, it doesn't matter anyway. I'll see him in the other lands tomorrow morn. My lord, he's not dead.
Ned looked at him as if he were thinking that Rodri was daft himself. Here was the crux, and Rodri steadied himself with a deep breath before he went on.
My lord, you must have heard the old saw, that eldest men often have a touch of the second sight.
It's true, and I'll swear to you that I know deep in my heart that Perrin's alive, and that he's bringing an army back to relieve the siege.
The lord's eyes narrowed.
Look at me, a misbegotten silver dagger. I've been in more battles and tavern brawls than most men even hear of. I've faced hanging before too, for that matter. Am I the kind of man to turn to fancies because he can't face death? Didn't you praise me for my courage on the field?
So I did.
The lord looked away, thinking.
I've seen you go berserk, too. Why wouldn't you have a touch of the sight as well, for all I know? But I know it sounds daft, but I beg you believe me. I know it's true. It comes to me in dreams, like. I know there's a relieving army on the way. But who? Oh, ye gods! My uncle!
Suddenly Ned grinned.
Of course Perrin would ride straight to Benwick. Well, if he's truly alive. I know he is, my lord. I'll swear it to you on my silver dagger. And that's the holiest oath a man like you can swear. Ah, by the black hairy ass of the Lord of Hell, what does it matter if we hang tomorrow or in an 8-night anyway? Come along, silver dagger. We've got to convince my allies of this, but I'll wager they'll grab at any shred of hope they can see.
4 days after she left Nedd's Dun, Jill rode back with an army of 220 men. Every last rider that Tyrion Benwick could scrape up, whether by calling in old alliances or by outright threats. As the warband filed into the ward, Sabin ran out, clutched the tyrant's stirrup as a sign of fealty, and began telling the lord everything that Perrin had told him over the past few days. Jill threw her reins to the stable boy and hurried into the great hall, where Perrin lay propped up on Ned's bed with a pair of boarhounds on either side of him, and three of those sleek little hounds known as Gwertraean at his feet. She shoved a dog to one side and perched on the edge of the bed to look over her patient, whose eyes were clear and alert, and his cheeks unfevered.
"Is the wound healing well?"
she said.
"It is. You must have brought my uncle with you from all the noise outside. I knew he'd come. If he didn't have me and Nerth to complain about, his life would be cursed dull."
At that, Benwick himself strode in, slapping his pair of gauntlets impatiently against his thigh.
"You dolt, Perro, and Ned's twice a dolt. But Natherick's a whoreson bastard having the gall to besiege my kin. Well and good, we'll wipe him off the battlefield for it. Are you riding with us?"
"I am. A wolf can run on three legs."
"Now wait a moment, my lord," Jill broke in. "If you ride, that cut could start bleeding again."
"Let it. I've got to go with them. I can lead the army through the forest, you see. We'll save 20 miles and a night that way."
"Splendid," Benwick said. "Glad to see you're finally showing some spirit, lad. Don't worry, Jill. We'll have your man out of that worm-riddled dun as fast as ever we can."
"Your grace is most honourable and gracious. If I were a bard, I'd praise your name for this."
With a small bow, she retired and left them alone. Out in the ward, a pair of Benwick's vassals were conferring with their captains, while the men unsaddled and tethered their horses outside for want of room in the stables. She went out the gates and walked about halfway down the hill, then sat down where she could be alone, and called to the grey gnome, who appeared promptly.
"Is Rodri still all right?"
It nodded yes, then hunkered down in front of her and began picking its teeth with one fingernail.
"You still haven't told me why you hate Lord Perrin."
It paused to screw its face up in irritation, then went on picking until it had finally gotten its fangs clean enough to suit it.
"Come on now, little brother. You could at least tell me why. Or is it too hard to explain?"
Rather reluctantly, he nodded his agreement to this last.
"Well, let's see. Did he hurt you or some other wild folk?"
"No, he hadn't done that."
"Can he even see you?"
"Apparently not, since it nodded a no."
"Is he an evil man?"
Frowning in concentration, the gnome waggled its hands as if to say, not exactly that, either.
You know, I'm having a hard time thinking up more questions.
It smiled, pressed its hands to its temples as if it had a headache, then disappeared. Jill supposed that she'd never find out the reason, but as long as the gnome behaved itself and didn't pinch the Lord or tie knots in his hair, it didn't particularly matter at the moment, not when she had Rodri's safety to worry about. She decided that she couldn't bear to sit here in Ned's mouldering dun and wait for news. Since she had a mail shirt and a shield of her own, on the morrow Jill rose and armed when the warband did. Once the army was mustered outside the gates, she led her horse into line at the very rear. Since these men had been hastily assembled from Benwick's various allies and vassals, everyone who noticed her at all seemed to assume that she was a silver dagger hired by some other lord. All that counted to them, truly, was that she was another sword. By keeping strictly to herself and speaking to no one, Jill escaped discovery all that day, because Perrin led the army off the road into the forest on a track so narrow that they had to ride single file. All day they wound around hills and through the trees, by such confusing paths that she prayed Perrin actually knew what he was doing. She also understood why all the provisions were on pack mules, not in carts. Apparently Benwick knew his nephew's daft ways very well. That night, however, they made camp in a mountain meadow, and there Jill was caught out. Like the excellent commander he was, Benwick made a point of walking through the camp and speaking to his men personally. When he came to Jill, he stared for a moment, then roared with laughter.
"Have all my men gone blind? Male or no male, Jill, you don't look like a lad to me. What are you doing with the army?"
"Well, Your Grace, my man's all I have in the world. I've got to see him with my own eyes as soon as ever I can."
"Huh. Well, we can't be sending you back now. You'd only get lost trying to follow Perro's wretched deer trails. You'd best come camp with me. You can keep your eye on Perrin's wound, and everyone will know you're under my protection."
When Jill shifted her gear over to the tyrant's campfire, she found Perrin there, slumped against his saddle. Although he was pale with exhaustion, he looked up and smiled at her.
"I thought you'd find a way to come along," he said.
"Why, my lord?"
"Just rather thought you were that sort of lass. I hope Rodri's worthy of you."
"I hold him so, my lord."
Nodding absently, he stared into the fire. She was struck by how sad he looked, a perpetual melancholy that was beginning to wear lines in a face too young to have them, as if he were in exile from some far country rather than among his kin.
"A puzzle, that one," she thought to herself.
On the morrow, Jill saw yet another puzzling thing about the Lord. Since she was riding right behind him, she could watch how he managed his leading. When they came to a spot where two trails joined or one petered out, he would wave the army to a halt, then ride a few steps ahead to sit on his horse and stare blankly around him, his head tilted as if sniffing the wind. For a moment he would look profoundly uncomfortable, then suddenly smile and lead the men on with perfect confidence. She was also impressed with his riding. Most of the time he left the reins wrapped around the saddle peak and guided the horse with his knees, while he swayed in a perfect balance in spite of having one arm in a sling. On horseback he looked much more graceful, as if his peculiar proportions had been designed to make him and a horse fit together in an artistic whole. About 2 hours before sunset, Perrin found the army a large meadow in which to camp and announced that they were a scant 6 miles from Greymon's Dun. After the horses were tended, Jill put a clean bandage on Perrin's wound, which was oozing blood and lymph, and tied up his sling again. Although he pleaded that he was too weary to eat, she badgered him into downing some cheese.
"We'll reach the Dun tomorrow," he remarked. "I can rest then, after the battle, I mean."
"Now listen, my lord. You can't fight. Trying to swing a sword would open that wound up again."
"Oh, don't trouble your heart about that. I'll just trot around the edge of things, see what I can see."
It was such a daft remark that Jill couldn't answer.
Well, I heard my uncle talking with the other lords, and they're thinking of riding right into battle."
He looked sincerely distressed.
"There's bound to be wounded horses, and maybe I can get them to safety."
"Oh, I keep forgetting how valuable horses are up here."
He nodded, staring into the fire as if he were working out some elaborate line of thought. It was some minutes before he spoke again.
Her cursed will hope that Nedd and Rodri are still alive. Although she knew that they were, she had no way of telling him.
So do I, she said instead.
You seem to honour your cousin highly, my lord.
I don't, because he's not truly honourable. But I love him. We were pages together in Benwick's Dun. I think I would have gone mad if it weren't for Nedd.
Was the tyrant as harsh as all that?
He wasn't, not truly. It was me, you see. I just, well,
As she waited for him to finish, Jill wondered if Ned's efforts